Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of the JT Fox Podcast Network. On this show, we interview some of the hugest, biggest A-list celebrities, billionaires, some of the most driven people. And this guest is someone I've been really, really looking forward to as well, because I remember seeing for one of the first times I went to the UK, remember seeing him on TV, and it just really struck me about his calmness and his rationale. It wasn't about ratings. It was just about getting straight to the point and really made a great impression on me when I watched the show. And it's been like a year and a half since I think I've been trying to get him on. And we finally have him on in between a conference. And I went upstairs and I said, I cleared the whole ballroom. I said, I'm doing this interview now. He is very accomplished in technology, in AI, also had a mountain bike company that he has built into one of the best in the world. I believe he was an executive director of a bank. In fact, it should be a show of what has he not done. So please welcome to the show, Piers Linney. How are you, Piers?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me. Thank you for clearing the ballroom.
Yes, please. Piers is here. Now, the people in the UK know who you are because we have people from all over the world here. So every single one knew who you were. Nobody else knew who you were, which does not accomplish, just like probably some people may not know another country as well. So why don't you just go over your background? Normally, I don't like doing that, but since there's so many people who don't know what you've accomplished outside the UK, and even though in the UK, I think I asked 10 people and 9 knew who you were. So that's very good brand recognition.
Yeah, it depends on whether you watch the shows that I've been on. So I'll start what I'm most famous for. So it's been a Dragon on Dragon's Den, Shark Tank in many other countries as well. But I was also a secret millionaire on a program here, which is a bit like Undercover Boss, where you go into a community and you're kind of undercover. But I was actually in a prison, a young offenders. That's my first sort of entree into the media. And I got picked up from there to go and do Dragon's Den. But my background, though, so my mum's from Barbados, the Caribbean. My dad's from Manchester in the north of England, if you know that town well.
Yep.
So I kind of grew up and I went to an awful school in the middle of nowhere, basically. And my aspiration was to be, I want to be in business. And everyone around us, they had a quarry, they had a construction business, making furniture, joinery, you name it. But no one had no one was a professional. And my dad, he worked for quite a large company. My mom was a nurse, so they couldn't really help me, really. And everyone said, you should be an accountant, which is not the best advice, as you can imagine.
No.
But that stuck with me. So I thought, and I grew up in where the Industrial Revolution started, quite literally.
What
so
year
the landscape
was that?
Scar.
What year was
so
that?
This is Lancashire. This is like 97. I mean, this is the late 70s now. I'm a child of the 70s, basically.
Right, right. But the entrepreneur, I was obsessed wasn't cool. With, entrepreneur wasn't cool back then. It only started.
It wasn't cool at all. It was going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or something like that. And anyway, so I decided that I love history, right? So I kind of grew up around this, the entrepreneurs of the age, and I thought I want to go into law. That was my thing that interested me. And everyone said people like you don't become lawyers. Anyway, cut a very long story short, I ended up becoming a lawyer in the city of London, a bit like Wall Street in the US. And I was pretty good at it, but I was a venture capital lawyer. And I saw the people doing the deals, the entrepreneurs and the fund managers. And this is pre-internet, this is JT. This is management buyouts, right? There's no tech investment. And I thought, I want to be one of those people, not me. But along the way, I'd always had businesses. I had my first paper when I was 13. I disintermediated the local newsagents and bought the papers wholesale myself. I had a film production business. My friend went on to run Lionsgate in Europe. So I've done lots of things.
I funded Lionsgate USA, so we have a lot, and I also had. So we may be a brother from another mother. So,
I won't mention the name, but he's a very good friend of mine. He ran it here, and now he left a couple of years ago. But he went into that, so I always had business along the way, forming companies, you name it. I kind of did it, but eventually, when I was a lawyer, I couldn't dot the I's and cross the T's. And someone said to me, "You should go into investment banking." And my response was, "What's investment banking?" Didn't have a clue. So I then saw my life really is look over the hedge, see something new and shiny, and learn how to go and do it and make it happen. So I then became a banker, and you'll know the name then, Credit Suisse First Boston. This is when Credit Suisse merged with First Boston. So it was a US bank culture, really. I ended up there for about 3 years. And I was a young M&A banker, so earning more money than I could spend. But I was always wanting to be in business. And when the internet wave, 1.0 came along, I got my bonus. I was lucky to be able to do that. Walked out, set up my first .com. And I've never worked for anybody since. So I was in, and then you'll probably find this quite interesting. I then brought pipes to the UK. So in the US, you'll know about private investment, public equity, hedge funds, private placement funds. No one here did that. So I kind of brought that kind of money to the UK. So I'm making quite a bit of money. And I became a part of the hedge fund. And the other businesses I invested in or started, they got to a size where I could actually start to run them. They were kind of a capital play, but also an income play. And I stepped into companies with about 300 people, telecom, some media, mostly technology. Some you win, some you lose, as you know in life. And then your point you mentioned, I became a director of the government bank. So during COVID, you had in the US, you know, this sort of payment protection plan. We had the COVID loan schemes. And we went from 12 billion to 90 billion in the market. So I was on the board of the government bank. So after TV, I kind of went down my mentor, who's Ken Alyssa, the Lord Lieutenant to the King in the UK. He said, you can go to the opening of an envelope, the opening of a fridge, and fall out of the nightclubs drunk, or you can be quite serious. So I went down the serious route. I was a trustee of the UK's largest innovation foundation. I started Atherton Bikes, which is 3D printed bikes. We won the world championship, first and second podiums 2 weeks ago in Scotland, in the UK. And I've kind of come full circle, really. And I think, if we can talk about this if you want to, that, you know, artificial intelligence is going to change our world. So I kind of decided, do I invest in technology? Do I invest in software? Or going back to the old Californian gold rush adage, do I sell shovels? So I decided to help companies understand AI and implement it in their business. And so that's kind of
you help companies stabilize. So you don't create the AI technology. You basically tell companies, here's how to use AI.
Well, we do. I always think that SaaS companies are kind of, they're going after the biggest TAM, you know, the total addressable market, really. And it's like a bell curve. They want to hit the middle. But most companies, they want to automate workflows and the way things that they do, the way they want it done. So we help companies understand the models and the SaaS and implement it. But also what I call, we design and develop AI agents. So think your workforce is a lot of people. And eventually you're going to start adding AI agents. They start to augment your workforce and eventually, inevitably, in some cases, replace it.
So wouldn't you say, there's so much to do that, but in the AI world, so many companies are starting right now and the majority won't make it, not because they're not good technology. It's just because whoever has more money, better R&D, will come up with a 2.0, 3.0 kind of version. And a lot of these small companies who went all in really can't compete against the Googles of the world or the Oracles of the world or the Microsofts of the world or the Amazons of the world. So is that a fair assessment that a lot of small business start AI probably won't survive, even though they have a great product, but it's changing so fast and so quickly?
Yes, it's quite different. So there's different levels, right? So if you want to develop a large language model, you've got to be OpenAI, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, very, very expensive, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, okay? So you need the infrastructure to run these things, supercomputers. You know, you've got to be able to buy 10,000 NVIDIA GPUs like Tesla just did. So there's that one level. But the issue is that most software as a service plays have now become or becoming a thin layer above these platforms. And the question is that increasingly you're seeing the platforms and stuff like OpenAI, they launched, you know, ChatGPT Enterprise. That has killed a number of SaaS startups. So rather than just sit at the platform level, they're actually delivering solutions for the enterprise, large and small. And that's going to disintermediate lots of SaaS companies. So to survive in AI, you've got to have a huge amount of data, the infrastructure play in your NVIDIAs, the models, and eventually the models over time are going to become a lot simpler, a lot cheaper to design and deploy and train and fine tune. You know, in 10 years, anyone will be able to do it essentially. So the beauty of this is we're getting into a world where access to technology is democratized. And what these LLMs allow us to do is to talk to technology in natural language. So there comes a day, I mean, you know, artificial general intelligence, I don't mean sentience, I just mean human level intelligence, where you can talk to a machine and say, go and do this for me. And let's go and do it. You don't need a software as a service company to develop some software that does a little piece of that for you. So what we're trying to do and implement AI is to help companies understand their options, look at their business, look at the low hanging fruit where they add the most value, and develop solutions and automations specifically for their business.
It's funny, I said the same thing. I said, you know, because everyone has marketing and agencies and branding agencies, right? And the problem is that all of these people that they hire, they write the copy on AI and they do the logos on AI and they use Mind Journeys and all the tools out there. And in theory, the owner could do it themselves, except it's like having a Bugatti and it's got all these buttons and you know how to use it all. And so, and people don't know how to use it all and they're confused because there's so much of it and people are stuck into their ways. And to somebody to come in and say, okay, here's what's happening. Here's how AI works. Here's how to implement it. That's an idea that I said, that's the future, AI implementation, not the sort of, I'm marketing and branding agency.
You've got to move, got to be able to move very, very quickly between the software side or have something which is, you know, really is unique or something where you've got an insight into a particular market that only you have actually seen and you move very quickly to plug the hole. But essentially, you know, everyone eventually is going to have this, you know, Microsoft Copilot and Google Duet. It's going to be everywhere. So it's like having spell check. Everyone's got a spell check. So the question then is, what's your differentiation? How are you going to create competitive advantage once everyone's got access to the same technology?
Unless they end up, there's a position that's, have they have a CTO becomes a AIO or something like that in a company specifically for those roles. But that's
Chow, Chief AI Officer. That's what we call them, Chow.
Chief AI Officer. Yeah. Let me go back in there. You went the sort of the job way and then the attorney way and then the corporate way.
But I always had side hustles, they call them now, along the way. There's always something going.
Yeah. And then you went the sort of like the all-in entrepreneur way, or sorry, the entrepreneur way, then the TV way. And then it seemed that you went to the government way, getting involved with government or more higher level prestigious positions, which in my experience, at least here in America, I know I do, the people all over the world listening to this, but it's usually not rewarding. It's very political. And so why go that way? Is it for branding? Is it for connections? Is it your sense of duty of giving back? Which, I mean, you know, that's still a lot of your time. And why started going to these different government type agencies after you've already made it into the corporate world or business world?
You're right. So, I mean, this is what we call, you know, non-executive roles here. So it's a question of learning something, giving back, extending your network. So the first big one was Nesta. It's a £600 million foundation here in the UK, biggest innovation agency in the country. So I was a trustee there for 6 years. And then I was asked to join the government, the board of the government bank. And that was kind of really to give back, really, to support small and medium-sized businesses to get access to finance because they struggle. But then, of course, COVID kicked in. So I signed up to do, you know, a board meeting a month. I was doing two a week with 200 pages of reading. So yeah, you're right. That does become a drain on your time, right, exactly. And it can't go on forever. But I thought that during that period of time, that was my way of kind of giving back, of you know, contributing something to, you know, coming up with a solution to the pain those small businesses suffered.
And then the TV world. So you could have continued doing TV. Obviously, there's the TV brain. Why not continue the TV route? Because obviously it's exposure, speaking engagements, you know, fame, deal flow.
So TV, I was what the BBC often call me, the reluctant celebrity, to be quite frank. I was always been quite B2B. So I didn't really have a product that you could go and look on the high street and go and buy it. But and I was on Dragon's Den, Shark Tank for sort of two seasons. I made quite a lot of money. I invested in a company that, you know, I put £100,000 in it. It sold for multiple tens of millions. So did okay out of it. But the point was for me was really about, it was about someone who looks like me. I advise some very large companies like Sky that's owned by Comcast on diversity and inclusion. There's more having someone like me on TV. So when they asked me to do it after Secret Millionaire, I said, I'm not sure I want to do it. And the producers were chasing me. And at the time, believe this or not, this is a true story, I'd arrived in Ulusaba, Sir Richard Branson's private game reserve in the Kruger National Park in South Africa. And I was there with him. I donated to his charity. And I said, who do I talk to about going on TV, media, the combination of these two things? How does it all work? You know where this is going. So I sat down with Sir Richard and explained the situation. And he said to me, look, you'd be good at it. There's no one like you on TV. Screw it, just do it. And I kind of said, oh, thank you, and walked away. And he said, no, come back. And he made me call the producer, who I still know to this day, and tell them that I'll do the program there and then. So that's where I actually ended up on TV. Now, a lot of TV, as you know, is about jeopardy and looking stupid. Yeah. You know, Dragon's Den Shark Tank works because that moment of jeopardy where you put your dreams on the table and five people with the number and say yay or nay, that's interesting. Most businesses, you and I both know, is flipping admin. It's not that exciting. So,
but also, you also know that whatever people tell us, right, on a pitch, once we go into due diligence, they either lied to us, misrepresented the numbers subconsciously or consciously, right? And so, as a business person who has a lot of companies, you know, I know a lot of the US, the US sharks, right? And you know what, and a lot of them said to me, you know, back in the day, most of the deals we did, we lost money and we just had to invest so we can stay on. And then they said a lot of the deals that once we went to due diligence turned out to be like there's other investors and a different story, right? Because there's no way you're, you know, it's made for TV, right? And they also said
about a third of deals where I did a handshake didn't happen. But mine was like a VC fund, right? I had, you know, probably what, 3/4 I lost money, I got my money back. I think 1 or 2, a little bit of return, and then one business returned the fund. You know, I made a lot of money out of it. And so it's a typical investment portfolio.
You said earlier that some worked out, some didn't work out. Were you talking about your own or investing in other people? Because that'll clear up.
Well, both. So on Dragon's Den.
Let me go back to you personally first on your businesses. I hate losing more than I love winning. And so when you lose, why did you lose? Maybe just an example, and what lessons did you learn and why did you end up losing? Because you're obviously smart, you're educated, you got a legal background, you got an M&A background, you got the connection, you got the stunning looks, and the company didn't work. So when you look back to what happened, did it not work? And what did you learn about yourself that we can convey to the audience here?
So there was somewhere, it's an investment, okay, where you didn't have complete control over it. So often, as you all know as well, is that, you know, the due diligence you did was okay, but a lot of these businesses are about the founder, really, and they didn't get the support they needed. But in most cases, the businesses where I've lost money, or I've started them myself, actually, where, and they're built about, well, not huge, but from scratch, you know, $15 million of revenue, kind of ARR, and haven't worked out, was timing. It was about, you know, I was too early or too late sometimes. So timing can be a massive impact on the potential of your business to succeed. Often it was management, and often you must have this in the business you have, is that it can be very difficult sometimes to change a management team. But what tends to happen in businesses as they start to scale, especially, is the management you started with, not all of them, but some of them, they're not the people to start scaling. And then there's people who help you scale and not the people sometimes to grow and mature, to grow and continue running and operating a mature business. And having those conversations and making those changes, I used to find very, very difficult. And that introduced quite a bit of risk. But as you get older and more mature and you've lost more money, not acting quick enough, you begin to step in and make those changes a lot earlier.
So was it the founders that didn't really come through, or was there companies that you did personally, because, or had you ran those?
So I've had investments, right? It can be founders, market.
But that's my point. Had you run those companies, would they have scale? Let's say you were in charge, right? Because I find that if I had just run the company or done the deal, I probably would have made it work. You know, who knows how big, right? Because you just never know on that. I just feel sometimes people don't have the same drive, the will to learn, the whatever it takes. And I think there's too many people who don't treat capital more conservative than their own.
You've got the drive, you think you have the know-how, but I just don't think that some of these businesses, they exist because they've come out of a founder's understanding. They've seen a problem or they've solved it. And I don't think I could have stepped in and run those businesses. I don't, even if, no matter how good I think I am, I've had businesses that I've started and haven't worked out. You know, I've spent 3 years of my life, and when they haven't worked out, you know, I wouldn't want to get out of bed for a month. So I don't really have I wouldn't stand here, or I'm standing actually, to try and stay fit and say that I could step into all those businesses and fix them. There are cases where you could have stepped in earlier and made some changes that would have reduced the risk of failure. But quite often it was just the technology wasn't right, the timing wasn't right.
Did you find out they didn't listen to you? Did you come to this? I have a coach of mine. He worked at Apple, worked at Microsoft, best friends with Jobs, best friend with Gates. And he used to go on the long walks with Steve Jobs, right? And Jobs would ask him questions and his feedback. Bill Gates, similar. And he goes, now they're founders that I'm involved as a VC. And I give them, do this, or this is what Jobs did. And he goes, they don't even listen to me. Like they don't listen to me. And it's very frustrating. You know, he's worth, obviously, very high net worth. And he goes, he just finds that people just don't listen, and they don't have respect for the capital that I was taught when I started. Always treat other people's money more conservative than your own. Now it's like, you know, OPM, other people's money, where all you have is your name, your credibility, and your reputation. So how do you see that? Do you feel like sometimes they don't listen to your advice, which you have so much, and they're ignoring it? Are you finding?
I don't have the same view, really. So I think that the world has changed quite a lot. And I think that we can think we have all the answers, but sometimes people see the world, it's a different world in a different way. I mean, I was the global hosting partner of the year in 2011 for Microsoft, right? Globally, I had lunch with Steve Ballmer, right? And he gave me lots of advice. And I'm glad I didn't take any of it because it was just wrong, especially about mobile, for example. Well, that's where I was just kicking off.
As you can see, Cadella did a good job turning that around, but that's fine.
Oh, yeah, he's the one on the sports side, I guess. But the world is changing. I think you can support, provide guidance, provide experience and share experience that you've got. But I think the world we're entering now is going to change rapidly. And I think that even people starting businesses now are going to be in the 5 years, especially 10 years, let's face it, you start a company, it's a 10-year deal, at least normally.
Yeah.
The world they're going to be operating in is fundamentally different to the one where we're now here, you know, standing in, talking, both standing up, talking about it. It's going to be
talk about the 10-year thing. What you said is, because if we go on social media, it's overnight, right? Everybody's a millionaire. Yeah. Everybody's a nine-figure. Everyone's a billionaire. Everyone's successful. I went on social media. You're not flash at all. Very similar to me as well. It's more value and education. And we live in a world where people are defined by the stuff they have or the stuff they show, which a lot of times we know they don't have.
I've been through that. I'm not going to hide the fact. I've had the Maseratis and the Porsches, done all that. But you kind of move on and you lose interest in that.
How about the 10-year plan? Talk about exactly what you said. Now, it takes about 10 years to succeed, which, by the way, yes, I've said that. And you're probably the first one who's ever said that as well, which it might be as not popular, but at the end of the day, it's the truth. And that's what people need to hear right now. So,
yeah. So everyone says, oh, I'm going to build a business, exit in 3 to 5 years, right? Which is typically a VC's 10-year funds want to get it in 5 to 7. Okay. That's that's what's driving that. It's a 10-year play, right? You are looking at, I'm generalizing that. It's two years just to turn the lights on and to find out, have you got product market fit? Does it work? And I'm not talking about tech companies now. It could be any company, right? Yeah. Then you're probably looking at another kind of 2 years to get your operational model in place. So your front end can't accelerate away and leave the back end behind operationally because it'll fall to pieces. And then you get into the point where, okay, I've got a model, I've got customers, I can monetize it. There's an ROI in my investment and my marketing. I can scale this. Now you're looking at scaling, depending on how much capital you have, whether it's going to be sort of a bootstrapped or you're raising finance. Then you're looking at a 3-year stretch of scaling it to prove. And then it's a question of, well, when do you get out? You know, if you sell your business and give all your money to some investment bank and they invest it for you. But then you're looking at, as you scale your series, B, C, when do you sell the business? Because there's still value on the table. And typically, before somebody comes along and wants to write you a check for that business, you're going to be looking at your 8, 9, 10. I know very few people, I know a lot of very wealthy people who've built businesses from scratch almost, in every case, but from scratch, and sold them within 10 years. So anyone who thinks that they're going to raise some money, like you say, other people's money, raise some money, build a business, exit it, and buy an island in 5 years, they're mistaken. And you and I both know it's not just 10 years of work, it's 10 years of grit, slog, and grind, risk, and sacrifice. Absolutely.
It does get a little easier though when you get branded. For example, you are very branded.
You scale, you've got people, you've got management, you've got
Got the money, the connections. Yeah. Like it gets a lot easier for me and you, but they don't understand what the first year is like.
But with that though, it's Spider-Man, isn't it? With more capital and people, it becomes more responsibility. So sometimes that can weigh down on you, but you're absolutely right. There is no bigger pleasure, that's why we both do it, in life than starting something, growing and building. And I must admit that the most pleasure I get from it is seeing the people that I have employed or built or trained go on and do great things. And
Does money move you? So if you did a deal now and you got £5 million that hit your bank account today, right? Would that make you happy, unhappy? Are you desensitized to it?
No, I'm not desensitized to £5 million, trust me. But
here's the way my position is. I'm not motivated by money anymore. I just look at it as a game. So what bothers me, the losses, right? Or not doing well. And so I hate losing more than I love winning. So when you win, it's like, okay, great. but it doesn't change anything. I'm not going to go buy anything with that 5 million right away. I'm not going to do anything. It's just on to the next deal, the next opportunity. Like, I don't, it doesn't drive
me. You spend your formative years trying to, you know, fill my, I bought this, you know, in Venice, my Venetian cup, trying to fill your cup. When it starts overflowing, what do you do with the overflow? And that's where you can, you know, the only mentor I've ever really kind of had, Sir Ken Alyssa, who's, again, Lord of Tenant to the King, he said to me, do well, do good. So put back. I try and help people like me that came from, you know, not a difficult economic background. My parents were okay, but I was sort of a background of schooling where very difficult to do what I did. I try to help people kind of access social mobility and social capital. That's what I like to spend my time doing. I invest in businesses still, be it mountain bikes, be it space. We're building a constellation of satellites for all of Earth. A friend of mine started a company. It's a real-time video of all of Earth. So it's always the new thing that excites me. But it's investing money. But I like what you said, actually. I never really heard that before. Is, you know, I hate losing more than I enjoy winning.
You know where I got that? True. Tom Brady. You know, and I asked Tom Brady.
Really? That's a good line, actually. But
my line. That's my line. But his line was, you know, his famous quote. And I asked him about it. When you say, what's your favorite ring? The one that, the one I haven't won yet. And the concept with Tom Brady was telling me is that, so you go in, you work all season, and then you win, right? A couple of days, you go to Disney, you know, welcome and all this hype. And you think, okay, I got to get back to it. Right. Because he goes, if you spent all summer celebrating, then you're not going to be ready for next year. He goes, if you lose, it bothers me all summer until I play again, until I win. And that's why I said that I'm the same way. I hate losing more than I love winning, because losing lasts until you win again. And, you know, I can just imagine in the UK, Lewis Hamilton, you know, I'm going to Red Bull at the facilities and getting a tour and meeting everybody at the end of the month. And I can just imagine Lewis Hamilton, you're winning. And in theory, as much as I like Red Bull, he probably should have won that last race, you know, in 2021 with Max, right? And then all of a sudden hasn't won since. And you're trying to win again. And that has to be, as a competitor, you know, it doesn't matter if they give him $40 million a year, $50 million a year, as a competitor, because that's why you want to win, that's got to bother you until he wins again. And you know what? Second, third place, nobody really remembers, right? They just remember Max Verstappen has just won 10 in a row, 10 out of the 12, right? So that's the mentality of why we do, which is why you're here on this podcast, to give back. You don't need to be on the podcast. You don't, you know, I don't need to interview that, but there's always that.
But in business though, okay. But in business though, I think there can be a slight fallacy that you've got to be, you know, the winner, the number one, you know, you can, let's face it, right? You can come in number two or three and do very nicely. Thank you very much.
But here's the thing. I tell people, did you do your best or did you do whatever it takes? If you gave a number one effort, then you'll win. May not be first place because you're competing against people that are bigger. I just think, which is going to lead me to the next question. You've met so many entrepreneurs, you've mentored, you've helped them. Why do some people don't make it? You're like, you know what? This is why this person didn't make it. Here's why they don't have it to be an entrepreneur. What's your answer to that?
So many reasons. I mean, I backed entrepreneurs that had, I thought it was a good business idea, they have execution, you know, they built a customer base, but they got to the point, going back to our sort of 10-year time frame, years two or three, where it just wouldn't scale. It just wasn't the market for it. So what happens is it become a lifestyle business. It's something that it's very difficult to get out of. There's no sort of exit. And that's because we thought the market was bigger than it actually was. So, and that those businesses eventually just kind of came to a grinding halt and they stopped. Now, I would back them again because the energy, the effort, the execution ability was there. It just it so happened that the market wasn't. Maybe I could have done more work on that, but you know, markets change. So, you know, I think entrepreneurs, that the point about being an entrepreneur if you're going from scratch, right, not buying a company, I bought lots of companies and built them, buy and builds. If you're going from scratch, it's a hypothesis, right? So you have a hypothesis, you test that hypothesis and it flies or it doesn't, just like a scientist. If it doesn't, you know, you've got to do your best, like you said, completely agree with that. Kill yourself as far as you can, especially using other people's time, energy, and money. But don't take it personally all the time that it was you that failed. As long as you've ticked those boxes about the effort, the energy, the commitment, you've done your homework, you've done the best you can. I've been there myself, right? Go again. Don't just, you know, hide under a duvet for the next 3 years.
But do you think everyone's meant to be an entrepreneur? Because it's a different skill
set. No, I don't. Absolutely not. And a lot of people I've met who think they want to be an entrepreneur, they realize very quickly it is not for them. You've got to have a particular psyche, mindset. You've got to be, you can't be risk averse. And lots of people that, I used to be a lawyer, right? The lawyers have gone into business and just struggled with it because it's been trained into them.
But you can sell, though. That's the difference. A lot of attorneys are very on a technical base of the law. You are very good. Yeah. Teaching law school, you're very good at selling, getting the clients. You know what I mean? A lot of them don't.
But not everyone to be an entrepreneur. I think that there's a business in everybody. It's like a podcast, isn't it? You know, not everyone should have a podcast, but everyone should try. It's a similar thing.
So, well, everybody wants to make money on the podcast. Do you agree with me that as much as my podcast is top rated and I've got people, without the podcast, I never would have met you. And here's the thing, I never would have met you because I'm true. Bringing you on and giving you value. If I just randomly send you an email and say, hi, I'm JT Fox, you're like, okay. I know Richard too, right? So like I'm busy, And so the idea of the podcast, sure, inspire, connect, but it's one of the great relationship builders because now clearly we have
But the beauty of whether it's technology, start a business, or it's a podcast, whatever it is that the barriers of doing this are coming down. It used to be, the internet was amazing and cloud open doors, need to own infrastructure. Now you can have technology that, I couldn't even dream of a year ago, never mind 10 years ago. So you want to start a business and be your own boss and be master of your own destiny. Now is the time to do it because, and you can say this every year, can't you? But we are entering a phase in, human development, the economy, society generally, where there's going to be a fundamental systemic permanent change. So if you're going to start a business, that's the time to do it.
I have a couple more questions. So you do business in the UK, you do business in Europe, and I think UK is very different than the rest of Europe. So it's not, of course, it's part of Europe, but I feel the UK is different than the rest of Europe. And then the United States. Can you give us a breakdown from how you see the difference between those three regions of doing business in America, in the UK versus in the rest of Europe?
I'm a lot in Europe, apart from raising money for my old hedge fund. Now I have worked in the US and the UK, and what's quite interesting, and this was when I was especially involved in pipes as well, and raising finance, investing in businesses. And in the UK, we talk about it's a very different investment climate in the US. It is, Americans, you have a very different approach to risk, to building businesses, to raising capital. It's completely different to us here. And I think part of it in the UK changing is that, failure was seen as something that, it was a black mark. Whereas in the US, in most cases, failure is seen as it's part of the training. And in the US, people are more, what I found is people, they're more willing to go, have a go, and get back up and try again a lot faster, and they can iterate a lot quickly. It's a different mentality. And often I think comparing the two is a mistake. And now here, I think we need to be more like the US, and it is changing. You're seeing that change in terms of the psyche of the next generation, but we're not quite there yet.
Let me ask you a question. So you won an award as a minority for the work you did. Some people call you black. Some people call it Indian. It's so funny. Like I think, and then I thought you said
I'm half Caribbean. So I'm half African American.
I do business in the Caribbeans too, in Nevis. So I like that as well. But do you think that a lot of these opportunities you've received are now received, including the TV show and the appointment, is because you're a minority and they have a sort of quota to fill? Or is it pure on your base abilities? Because I speak to you, and as I look at the screen, I don't see a minority. I just see this highly driven individual who's making a very big difference. And so do you think these opportunities are advantage as a minority, or because you're a minority, it was harder to succeed?
So for me to get into the city equivalent of Wall Street in the US, that definitely wasn't okay. It was hard work. I applied to 70 law firms, 68 law firms to get one offer, literally. That's never really helped me. I've sat in, meetings where I sit in meetings and it's my meeting. I'm paying everyone in the room, and people, I arrive early. People turn up, they're sitting down, they're checking social media, looking out the window, ringing their mom, sharpening their pencil. And I said, we're going to start the meeting. And people look around and say, we're waiting for peers. Because no one expected peers to look like me. So I've kind of been through this through all my whole life. Now, I think now, having been on TV, there are two sides to that coin. One is that everybody thinks they kind of know you, where they create a caricature of you. It's not really me. I'm quite different, quite private. But let's face it, it opens doors. People will take your phone call. Whether you want to talk to somebody, or if you want to sell something, people will take that phone call. So that's powerful, actually. And that's something that has really helped me along the way.
Closing, what's the best advice you've received for everybody here around the world? Because I'm truly inspired. I like just talking to you now is such an excitement, and I could see the enthusiasm and the passion still for it, which it's hard to put inside, it's hard to take out. What advice do you have for everybody else when it comes down to success?
Wow. So, I mean, the advice I tend to give is two things, really. One is, so there's two aspects to it. So my success was because other people gave me a chance. So that was the first thing, is that people looked to me and saw there was something in it. And whether you're a senior manager or an individual, the people are going to come across where you can pick up the phone, make a difference, add that little smidgen of social capital, a contact that can change people's lives. But I think the other point is about is best advice is that now I've been through, you know, web 1.0 to web 0.3. You know, I missed the first couple of industrial revolutions. Now I'm not that old, but I'm now looking at the fourth industrial revolution. If you want to start a business, you want to start an opportunity, have a business where there's a huge opportunity, there is some systemic change, something is moving. Think of, you know, I know billionaires from mobile phones, billionaires from cloud computing, billionaires from, you know, managed service infrastructure. Play into a large wave, swim into it, and now's the time to do it. And that's why, you know, I'm very much focused on artificial intelligence, because
you have a book out,
a wave I need to swim into. No, you know what? I've been asked that quite a lot. I don't know what I'd write it about. I'm too private to write a book about my personal life.
I think you should put an online course, kind of like your podcast, where you'd be able to just take your iPhone and then just record, and then just kind of put some content out there to give back on fundamentals. Because I think
I made a course. So I was a bit like you. I was tired of all that advice on the internet about Ask the Universe, you know, straight line growth. It's all nonsense. So I made a course. So I thought I'd make a few videos. Ended up being 76 lessons, 10 and a half hours. And I tend to actually give it away. So if you've got a link in your podcast,
I'll give you my cell phone number. Send it to me. And by the way, PiersVinny.com, obviously a great website, by the way, and a very pretty website, by the way. And I think you guys should follow him on social media and let him know how you think you feel about this interview, because it's good to get feedback. Second, you and I we had never talked, we had never met, we didn't know who I was. I knew who you were, but and we just got in, and 2 minutes later, we pressed the button 2 minutes later. What would you say when we did this interview? So for people from a learning perspective, and I purposely, would you say, what are we going to talk about? And I said, let's just wait until the interview, right? Because I don't like asking the same question twice, because it doesn't make it as authentic as real. But what did you think of this interview? And what do you think of me now that we've done this interview?
So I checked you out quickly, because you were sort of asked me to be on there, and I looked at it and I think, wow, you cover a lot of ground. The number one for me is I couldn't do that. I need to be more or less quite focused on coming out of property, food to technology. I didn't focus on technology. That's what interests me, really. So I was quite surprised by your breadth of interest. That was quite an interesting one as well. And also just the fact that, you know, you get things like this done. It's not easy fitting this into a schedule.
Worth it.
And you're a great example, even better than I am, to be quite frank, of building a personal brand. That's not, as people think it's easy, and it isn't. It requires a lot of work and it requires strategy.
Yeah, no, but you know, you're right. The Dragon's Den, it could be 20 years from now, people still say Dragon's Den. And there's some things, the thing about branding is if you do one thing, it could last for a lot of different things, no matter how many more gray hairs you have or if you look different or not as well. And I think what I've learned here from today is your authenticity, you're willing to give back, you're willing to say yes to opportunities. But there's something that caught my attention too is, you know what, my mentor, and I have coaches and mentors too, I bounce off ideas. There's heroes, models, and coaches and mentors. And, you know, sometimes someone said to me, and I ask a very famous Lando Norris, by the way, the race car driver, I was like, how do you drive the car, you know, without thinking you're going to die? It's, you know, 320 kilometers, 200 miles. Like, how do you not think about dying? Right. People can't even handle, you know, 100 miles an hour, let alone that. And he says, if you think you're going to die, you're going to die. Right. If there's even 1% doubt, you need to go in 100% focused on what is it that you do and hope that it all works out the best. And because doubt starts creeping in.
So if you haven't got a mentor, someone to give you those nuggets of a sort of helpful information and support, try and find one. And if you don't mentor somebody, if you're listening to this, then find someone that could do a bit of support. and provide some. It hasn't got to be sort of particularly formal.
Well, you could listen to the 76 modules. There is 76 modules, or listen to Pierre's podcasts and on YouTube. There's plenty of resources of him speaking, which is very authentic and very good. You're the real deal, my friend. So that's it. If you like this, do me a favor, share it, give it a rating, pass it on, and let that help. This is real conversation. And also 10 years. I know it's not what people want to hear, but I think it manages expectation that when it doesn't work on the first day or second day, then you know what? Then you know you have a problem.
Yeah, you can have a life, nice life in years 5 to 10. You just haven't exited.
Yeah. And absolutely, but you're going to realize that doing nothing is also boring. It's not a bunch of cash of money, and that doesn't fulfill you as well. So stay on the line here. Thank you very much, everybody. Check Pierre's out. Phenomenal, hearted individual and a model of what an entrepreneur should be here today, and a proof that started with a job, started with nothing, climbed his way up, always seeking for the next deal, the next opportunity, the next trend, and the next relationship. We will see you on the other side. Thank you. See you next time.